Undisciplined is a collaboration between African and African-American studies at the University of Arkansas and KUAF.
The podcast provides a peek into the complex issues that affects our interconnected world.
Taking the interdisciplinary approach of African and African-American studies to the classroom, into the community, onto the airwaves, and beyond. I am your host, Dr. Karee Banton, and for this sixth season, I have a new co-host,
Carrie Nisia Connor.
Let's get into it. Brian, welcome to Undisciplined again. You're becoming a regular.
I just want my favorite things to do. Thank you for having me.
Oh, wonderful. Victor Lukerson, thank you for coming to the Undisciplined show.
Thanks. First time, but excited to be here.
Oh, wonderful. And Carnice and I are so excited for this program today.
Yes. Super excited. Brian, it's been great to work with you so far. Yes, I'm glad that you're here in the studio. For y'all that don't remember, Brian Hembree is Director of Arts and Culture of the Multicultural Center at the University of Arkansas. And we have him here in studio today because he's one of the lead sponsors of the Common Ties program here at University of Arkansas, which is what has brought the esteemed author and journalist Victor Lukerson to the studio today. But before I give his introduction, I would love, Brian, for you to talk about Common Ties and what that program is.
Sure. Common Ties is a yearly program that is a partnership between College of Education, specifically Curriculum and Instruction, and the Multicultural Center. And it's an opportunity for long-form learning where we bring near service teachers that are getting ready to graduate from the BAT program together with student affairs staff, to really dig deep on a subject that they may not have had a lot of access to before in this format, and that has implications not only on their potential future teaching, but also the work we do on campus as student affairs professionals.
Okay, so you work with my folks,
yes.
Curriculum and Instruction, which is how we know each other. That's awesome. And so what is the project that you're working on this semester?
Sure. Every year there's a different topic that Common Ties digs into. So in the past, we've looked at broad form history of the Holocaust, Vietnam. And 2 years ago, I introduced the possibility of looking at Tulsa history, Greenwood history, the Tulsa Massacre, Black Wall Street. And we really had a great opportunity with that project because not only was it intensive learning on campus, but we took a trip to Tulsa with the participants and really got to immerse ourselves in Tulsa and in Greenwood. And so it was an opportunity at that time. I reached out to Victor Lukerson, started having dialogue. But Victor was in the throes of finishing his book that's now out. And so we kept that kind of flame burning, so to speak. And this year it made sense to cycle back again. This is a chance to revisit it. Tulsa and Greenwood are so important, not just because of its national significance, but also its proximity to where we are. And so, for example, we can do a day trip with students and staff and be back, but still have a meaningful, experiential aspect of the long-form learning.
That is absolutely right. Yeah, it's just 2 hours down the road.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, not far at all. I was surprised how close it was, honestly, when I made the drive out here to Fayetteville today. So.
You got to come see us more often.
Yeah,
for sure.
No doubt.
Well, a little bit about Victor Lukerson. He is a journalist and author based in Tulsa who works to bring neglected Black history to light. He is a former staff writer at The Ringer and business reporter for Time magazine. His writing and research has appeared in The New Yorker, The New York Times, Wired, and Smithsonian. He was nominated for a National Magazine Award for his reporting in Time on the 1923 Rosewood Massacre. He also manages an email newsletter about underexplored aspects of Black history called Run It Back. So we're glad that in your desire to run this program back, you decided to bring Victor Lukerson to campus.
I like that. Yeah, thank you. Thank you.
Run it back.
Run it back. So Victor, tell us a little bit about your work. How did you get into journalism and what led to your writing Built from the Fire?
Yeah, so I really have been writing since I was 5 years old. I'm from Montgomery, Alabama, and I can remember being a little kid tooling around on my parents' typewriter. I'm not old enough to be from the typewriter era, but we had one in my house. And so really just from almost from the time I can remember, I've been writing. It was really when I went to college at the University of Alabama that I realized that journalism was sort of the path for me. That's when I realized that there are ways to tell stories the way I always had that could really like impact the world and real people in a significant way. I think especially being somewhere like University of Alabama, you know, a very large, mostly white institution similar to Arkansas, that's kind of when I really realized there's a lot of buried history, you know, in our past. For example, at the University of Alabama, if you're from Alabama, you learn a lot about the standing in the schoolhouse door when our governor, George Wallace, sort of famously tried to prevent two black students from attending the school, but he was forced to step aside, and it's kind of this victory for civil rights. But when I was a student there, I learned that there had actually been another black student named Authorine Lucy who went to school there in 1956, was run off campus by a white mob and the Ku Klux Klan, and was basically forced to resign from the school after 3 days. Yeah. And that's a much tougher history to learn that we don't really get taught, or I didn't get taught when I was growing up in Alabama. And that was kind of my first, I think, exposure to the fact that the narrative of history that you learn in high school or just sort of as a general American is not our full story. And so I think that understanding really kind of set the stage for me to be really interested in the story of Greenwood and Black Wall Street. I know that if you fast forward a few years after that, I was living in Atlanta working as a tech journalist, actually. But I actually had a conversation with one of my friends over lunch one day, and the movie 12 Years a Slave came up in this conversation. And my friend was telling me how he had never seen the movie, he didn't really want to see the movie, because he was tired of only seeing black folks brutalized in historical depictions, right? Because so many times when we're put on the silver screen in history or even in books, often it's about black folks being brutalized as slaves or maybe sick by dogs in the civil rights movement. And I asked my friend at that time, have you ever heard of Black Wall Street? That's an example of us being successful. My friend had never heard of it. This is before Watchmen had come out, before President Biden and President Trump had visited Tulsa. And when I realized that there were like so many people my age who had just never even known about this story of black success, that's actually what initially motivated me to want to go visit Greenwood for the first time and kind of see what this place was. You know, I had known a little bit about Black Wall Street, as that's kind of what it was in my head at the time, this sort of Black Wall Street mythology. I known a little bit about it, but I didn't really know the full story of it or what the place was really like. And so I think going there for the first time really opened my eyes to what Greenwood was and how Greenwood itself is a little bit different than that Black Wall Street mythology.
Wonderful. I'm hearing, you know, you're kind of like bringing together history and journalism as disciplines, and both have been complicit in some erasure,
right?
I would like for you to kind of speak to your trained journalists, and what journalists choose to write about is a part of the silencing of that history. Can you speak to that a little bit, the role that journalism has played, the kind of language? In my class, you know, I tell my student to call it a race massacre rather than a riot, right? Just those kinds of language and all of that kind of stuff, those choices that we make as journalists. How do you believe that has shaped this erasure that you're talking about?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think the role of the media is very instrumental in everything about the race massacre and how it unfolded. You know, I remember during my research, I spent a lot of time really studying white media in Tulsa before 1921, before the race massacre. And, you know, one of the things that was really striking to me was learning about all the racial violence that preceded the massacre. You know, in Oklahoma in the 1910s, there were lynchings happening every year of black people all around the state. And in particular, there was a lynching of a woman named Marie Scott in a town called Wagoner, which is not far from Tulsa. This was in the late 1910s. She was lynched and hung in front of a store on Main Street in this town. And in the Wagoner newspaper, there was an editorial right after she was killed that said that, you know, sometimes a lynching is warranted, you know. And so you see the media actually endorsing this vigilante violence consistently in Oklahoma before the race massacre. And then the race massacre itself, the actual event that sort of precipitated the events was a shoeshine boy named Dick Rowland, a black shoeshine boy named Dick Rowland, stepped onto an elevator with a white attendant named Sarah Page. The elevator lurched, and Dick Rowland probably grabbed her arm or stepped on her foot, but she screamed, and Dick Rowland ran away. He was arrested by Tulsa police on a attempted rape, is what they said, which is untrue. So this event, I mean, this event in and of itself would have, you know, been unknown probably to all of Tulsa, except for the fact that the Tulsa Tribune, a white newspaper, wrote an article about it and exaggerated what had happened to such an extent that it caused white Tulsa to want to form an unruly mob to go seize Dick Rowan from the jail and lynch him. And so that's an example of white media sensationalism actually leading to this horrific violence in some sense. But in terms of erasure, what I realize is that I think that element of the story is pretty well known, that this white newspaper article kind of set off the events. Mm-hmm. And so I spent a lot of time actually kind of looking for coverage of Greenwood in the white press. And what I realized was that so much of what was happening in Greenwood was actually invisible to white people in Tulsa at that time.
You know,
there would be some stories about crime happening in Greenwood. And obviously we have this sort of made up crime with the Dick Rowan case. But in terms of just like day to day life in Greenwood or success in Greenwood, that was never being covered in the white press, neither before the race mask or really even in the decades afterwards. And so you really had to go to the black press to get an actual account of what was going on in Greenwood on a day to day basis.
And you're able to find those accounts?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, for me, as a journalist, and, you know, I think it was an interesting journey for me to write this book and really be exposed to black media in a really in-depth way, because I've never worked for a black outlet. I was trained in a very traditional, mainstream, you might say, like, white-centric approach to journalism. And so, for example, at the University of Alabama, it was just very, like, the whole point was objectivity, right? That's what you learn when you're in class at the University of Alabama in my journalism program. The job is to be objective. I worked for Time Magazine for several years after college, and I remember very specifically there that I was living in New York City when I worked there, actually, and it was right when the Black Lives Matter protest had started, and you were banned from going to the protest if you were an employee at the company, actually.
Wow.
And so I remember talking to my editors about that, and I remember in particular the fact that, like, it was sort of assumed that I wouldn't even care about that. You know, it was kind of a given that, oh, of course you don't care about going out to that, Victor.
They tokenized you.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, not you. You're a good guy.
Yeah.
You're not rowdy,
but never.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, that was sort of the framework under which I came to understand what journalism is. So it was really interesting for me to engage with this book project and really dive into the black media. You know, the book itself centers around a family that's owned a black newspaper in Tulsa for more than 80 years. And so I just read tons and tons and tons of issues of this black newspaper. And I really came to understand that there are actually like other ways to approach journalism besides the idea that I need to be looking at this from 5,000 feet above to have any kind of credibility. You know, very often the Oklahoma Eagle, the newspaper, was in fact activists and advocating for people of Greenwood. Very often the editor of the newspaper would be like negotiating for jobs or opportunities for people in the community. Like, they were very much part of the community instead of having that sort of like objective space apart that they thought gave them credibility. And so for me, I think it was really eye-opening to see that, you know, there's actually a whole nother sort of framework to approach journalism. And I think that idea, I think the idea of objectivity in journalism being the end-all be-all has come under a lot of scrutiny the last 5 to 10 years. But when you look at the black media, they never had that mindset in the first place.
Or the luxury.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. There was a guy, doing my research, I read a lot of, at the Columbia University, they actually have an archive of interviews with black journalists from the 1970s. So these are a lot of black journalists who were working during the era of Jim Crow, right? People who founded newspapers in the 1910s, 20s, and 30s, and Deep South, and all kind of places. And one of these journalists, Charles Loeb, worked in Cleveland. He had this really amazing quote that said that it's hard to be objective when there's a foot on my neck.
Yeah.
And that to me really captured like the dichotomy of being a black journalist and how some of the some of the sort of rules you learn that are supposed to be sort of what makes you a quote unquote good journalist don't necessarily apply when you're sort of faced with this structural oppression that's been sort of framing your existence from day one, you know.
Wow. So you mentioned the black media of the time. So Tulsa set the scene, 1921, when this massacre occurs. And I love that Kareem brought up, you know, the idea of riot versus massacre, because I'm from Texas and our Texas Essential Knowledge and Skills calls it a race riot.
Oh, wow. You know? Even now?
I don't know about now, because I've been out of the Texas school system for a minute. But when I was a teacher, that's what it was.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
And so I don't see it getting any better.
Indentured, you know, interns.
Right.
And all kinds of things.
Wow. Volunteer. volunteers. They enjoyed it. Mm-hmm. It was really interesting to see someone actually kind of name it for what the reality was and the lived experience for Black folks. So, but what is this Black media? What was this newspaper called?
Oh, so there were two newspapers in Greenwood during the 100 years that my book covers. The first paper was called the Tulsa Star. Mm-hmm. And so it was founded by this guy named A.J. Smitherman, from Alabama, actually, like me. Mm-hmm. And, he was probably the most, activist journalist I've ever encountered. He was the kind of guy who would, not only write about how lynching was wrong, but go try to, break up the mob. He'd be in the mix, you know?
Hey, okay.
Trying to say he was not going to put up with racial violence, by any stretch.
We won't go.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And so, but I really appreciate about Smitherman in particular is he was a very principled journalist, so he would write these missives about lynching and kind of talk about how, no one should be lynched. It doesn't matter if you're Black or white, rich or poor, even if you did the crime. We have a justice system to sort of walk through those steps, you know? And so I really appreciate how principled he was. However, during the race massacre, A.J. Smitherman's newspaper was burned to the ground, the printing press was burned to the ground, and he was actually charged with inciting a riot, even though obviously he didn't do that. And so he actually was banished from the city as a fugitive and never came back for the rest of his life.
Wow.
But after Smitherman was forced to flee, a new newspaper was founded right after the race massacre called the Oklahoma Eagle. And the Goodwin family actually purchased this newspaper in the 1930s, and they've had it ever since then. Mm-hmm. And so in my book, I actually follow the Goodwin family from when they arrived in Greenwood in the 1910s from Jim Crow, Mississippi, how they survived the race massacre, how they ended up buying this newspaper in the 30s and sort of became sort of the stewards of documenting the story of this community. And they still do that today. You know, if you go to Greenwood right now, the Oklahoma Eagle is the only Black-owned property, actually, in Greenwood. Wow. And so it is. And so it's actually in this old auto garage. It's been repurposed into a newspaper office now. Jim Goodwin, the owner and publisher of the paper, is in his 80s now. He's also an attorney. He works every single day still on both jobs.
Wow.
And so getting to know this family and, you know, all they've done to help not only defend this community, but honor it by chronicling its story week in, week out. That's really been a great aspect of this work, I think.
Mm. Yeah. Well, we've heard, a lot about the different characters, whether it was the young man in the elevator, right, who was blamed for, making this attempted rape, or the other luminaries, the rich folks, around owning helicopters and theaters and all these restaurants and businesses and all of these things. You know, people like John Home Franklin, right? Yeah. One of the greatest statesmen of African-American history, even now. That's what African-American studies, that's what we use for African-American experience course, From Slavery to Freedom, John Home Franklin's book. Can you tell us about some of the other characters, whether, they've been silenced because of their gender or their, class or any other issue, who we should be knowing about as the public?
Sure. So a big part of what I wanted to do with Built from the Fire was step inside the Black community in a more intimate way. I think a lot of times when you read books about American history or the Black experience in American history, it's kind of like a Black versus white thing. So you just here's what the Black folks were up to. Here's what the white folks were up to.
Yeah, they don't know that sometimes we don't be liking each other.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
None of my ilk.
Right.
Exactly.
Skin folk theory.
Yes.
Yeah.
Skin folk,
Exactly. And so in my book, instead I said, white people's role in this book is to basically help set the structure of the oppression, basically. So you get to see how the state of Oklahoma, created Jim Crow when it became a state, how the city of Tulsa brought Jim Crow through city ordinances. Obviously, how the white mob destroyed Greenwood. But I was much more interested in terms of how we're going to get the people in an intimate way. What is under this structure? What are Black people doing? And how are they debating the best way to move forward? Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Super influential then.
Yeah. Now, the Tulsa Star was kind of like Black Twitter because he'd be calling people out in the neighborhood on the front page sometimes. And
memes of 1921.
Yeah.
Public shaming.
Exactly. But in terms of specific folks, I think so. Under that framework, I really wanted to highlight who are people besides sort of male entrepreneurs? Because I think Greenwood's sort of mythology is tied up in a lot of male entrepreneurs doing their thing.
And the whole idea of the Black Wall Streets, wherever they may exist, because it was not only Greenwood.
Right.
Yeah. It's always kind of underpinned by masculinity.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, yeah, women are often left out of that story, and there are other people, probably because of their class, because the kind of capitalist nature of the storytelling, we don't get to hear what they're doing.
Yeah. We need to hear it, because we got the 50-50 narrative going on right now about paying bills in the Black household.
Yeah.
So we need to understand who was working, what was happening, what did female entrepreneurship look like in Tulsa?
Sit tight through this commercial break. We'll be right back.
I'm Denisha Simpson.
And I'm Joy McGowan.
And we are the co-host to the Resilient Black Women podcast. Our podcast is all about demystifying mental health for Black women, women of color, and women everywhere.
You can learn more about our work with our nonprofit and our podcast by visiting resilientblackwomen.org.
You can also listen to our podcast at KUAF.com or subscribe to our podcast on any streaming platform.
Welcome back.
Yeah, so one of the women I really focus on in the book is Lula Williams. She owned the Dreamland Theater, which is probably the most famous business in Greenwood history, to be honest. If anybody watched the Watchmen TV show, the Dreamland Theater is very prominently featured on that television show.
I watched an episode yesterday.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So Lula, I think her story is really interesting because when I came to her story, actually, I made a lot of assumptions that were gender normative about, you know, how her story played out. Mm-hmm. There's a very famous photo of Lula and her husband John in this Norwalk car, which is kind of like the Rolls Royce of 1912 or whatever. So, you know, they were doing big things.
Black on luxury. Fleek. Turned up in
Tulsa. We've been luxurious.
Yeah, exactly. So in this photo, John is driving and Lula's in the passenger seat. And so I see this photo and now almost subconsciously I'm assuming things about how they interacted, what their dynamic was, and all this kind of stuff. But when I was researching the Dreamland Theater, I was going through a lot of property records for the property, and I found this affidavit that Lula had signed in Tulsa County Courthouse that said, "I, Lula Williams, own the Dreamland Theater. I own the popcorn machine. I own the projector. I own the seats. John Williams does not own any of these things.
Put my name on the orange juice. Yeah. Please, everybody, I own that."
Yeah, yeah. And so that was really kind of opened my eyes to how independent she was and what she was advocating for. Mm-hmm. And so in the book, I talk a little bit, I kind of give you an arc about her story, where she went from, I mean, she was instrumental in the creation of the movie theater, but when the first articles were written in both Black and white Tulsa, she wasn't even mentioned one time.
Oh, wow.
And so you go from her being not even mentioned in the creation of the theater to her, like, you know, signing these documents saying, like, "I actually own all this stuff just so everybody knows." And then before the race massacre happened, she actually was having articles written about her that instead said she was the amusement queen. You know, she was the greatest entrepreneur in Oklahoma, all this kind of stuff. And actually, she opened up two more theaters around Oklahoma before the race massacre. So this is a Black woman owned three movie theaters across the state. You know, absent the race massacre, that could have been the AMC of today. You know what I mean?
And she still had love.
Yeah.
I think that was kind of a protective mechanism. How do you extrapolate from that? Is it, was she trying to protect her man? Do you suspect maybe they owned it jointly but put it in her name because of maybe danger? Or do you think it was her striking out and declaring her independence and her entrepreneurship? How do you make sense of that?
I mean, I think it could have been a mix of things. I know that, like, listen, for example, her son, WD, became a teacher in Tulsa later, and he was actually one of the main, most instrumental people in spreading the Greenwood story. So there's many oral histories about WD that you can find. And he would say in his oral histories, "Oh, yeah, my mom was the one who was good with the finances," you know?
Oh.
And so I think it's a mix of things, because actually there's a pattern in Greenwood of women being on a lot of the property deeds.
Oh.
So a lot of the land that a lot of those famous businesses, for example, O.W. Gurley is sort of thought of as like the founder of Greenwood.
Right.
He opened the very first business in 1905, a grocery store on Greenwood Avenue. But the property deed is in his wife Emma's name, actually.
Hmm. Oh.
And so it's like a very common dynamic. I've talked to some other academics who've told me that in the West, actually, that was more common for women to be on the property deeds as opposed to in the Deep South, which could be something about like cultural norms.
Does it have to do something with the indigenous, black indigeneity, Brian?
Yeah, I was going to say that stems from the Brady family too. Tate Brady was this Ku Klux Klan, member, but also really kind of orchestrator. And his wife was Cherokee, and so many of the allotments that she had were in Greenwood, and then his daughter as well. And you see both of their names, on these allotment plots. And so there's quite a bit of that in Greenwood. It is very. I don't know that it's that normal because I haven't compared it elsewhere, but it definitely skews heavily towards female ownership, and that's pretty incredible.
Yeah, but when you learn the Greenwood mythology, those names don't come up often,
Right.
And so it was important for me to kind of recenter the narrative on where the facts led me. Again, it wasn't like I didn't really come in necessarily expecting to do that, but all the facts told me that Lula Williams actually was the person who masterminded the Dreamland Theater, for example. And then just in terms of class, too, I wanted to talk about that a little bit later in the story. So the book goes on well beyond the race massacre. And I actually ended up interviewing a man named Washington Rucker, who grew up on Greenwood Avenue, but was born into abject poverty in Greenwood and grew up in that context. And he told me a lot about going to the schools there. And he's still living. He's very dark-skinned, Washington. And he told me that when he was going to school in Greenwood, he wasn't allowed to get a musical instrument in the classes in middle school because he was dark-skinned. Wow. Like, they were for the light-skinned kids, basically.
Wow.
And also, he was from a poor family. So one of his quotes that really stuck out to me was, I grew up in Greenwood, but I didn't have a name. There were names in Greenwood that were sort of known to be influential families.
Right.
But if you weren't in those families, you didn't necessarily get all the same opportunities.
Hmm.
And so it was important for me to also kind of talk about those class dynamics and how another thing Rucker told me was that the name Black Wall Street meant nothing to him. That name did not resonate with him as somebody from Greenwood. He thought of it as Greenwood or Deep Greenwood, not as Black Wall Street.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think sometimes those mythologies, as you point out, end up leaving a lot of people out of the story who actually have a lot of experience and knowledge to share with us about what it was like to be black in Tulsa at that time.
Yeah, that's really interesting because, in Tulsa you see a sign that says Black Wall Street, and
right.
It's on Greenwood Avenue.
Mm-hmm.
And so I remember as a kid thinking, like, Greenwood Avenue was Black Wall Street, but Greenwood was the larger community.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that even conveys to, to my knowledge, really, So
there's that conflation.
Yeah. So, it has a street, and that is the business district. And, if you go there today, there's still a few kind of the business buildings left that were rebuilt in 1921, 22, that are there. But, it's fascinating.
So you spoke about how, Tulsa was in 1921 is this mecca for black ownership and entrepreneurship, and it was littered with black business. And today, only one black business is remaining in that area?
Well, one piece of black-owned property.
Okay.
There is, so if you go to Greenwood now, there are, as Brian pointed out, two older buildings that were rebuilt after the race massacre that have been preserved.
Mm.
They're operated by the Greenwood Chamber of Commerce, which is like a nonprofit that has, varying board members and kind of different ownership structures and all that over time, what I mean? And so there are some black-owned businesses in those buildings. There's also two churches left. Both of them were burned down during the race massacre, Vernon AME and Mount Zion Baptist. But they're still there. And then there's the Eagle that's there, which is the only, owned by an individual black person who could do with it what they wish. That's the only thing that's kind of in that sort of classic Greenwood entrepreneurship mold that's there. But beyond those spaces, much of Greenwood now is part of Oklahoma State University, which came in after urban renewal to take over a lot of the property. There's a lot of private white-owned development in the neighborhood, Holiday Inn, for example, and things like that. And then also there's a baseball stadium, actually, in Greenwood. And so for me,
you're playing baseball there.
Yeah. And so my very first time in Greenwood, like I said, I had learned about Black Wall Street and really wanted to come see, the black success and everything like that, and also understand how the race massacre had impacted this place.
Mm-hmm.
And so my very first time there was on the anniversary of the race massacre in 2018. And I was really expecting to, see a lot of reverence for the space. This is the anniversary when all these people were murdered. But actually, when I went, there was a vigil happening, and there were maybe 30 people or so at this vigil, on Greenwood Avenue, but there were hundreds of people actually in the neighborhood streaming into the baseball stadium. Mm. So there were more folks who cared about minor league baseball that day than the fact that black girls had been murdered on this very block 97 years before. Mm. And so that was really kind of what activated me to say, okay, we got to go a lot further, making people aware of what's going on here. If y'all care more about baseball than the race massacre, we got to change this up. Mm-hmm. And so that's really what motivated me to want to go deeper with the story and actually write a book and not just an article about it.
Yeah. Well, tell our listeners, give us the story of Greenwood before the race massacre and during and maybe just a little bit after.
Sure.
What's the narrative? What's the story?
Yeah, I mean, it's a story, I think, of black success and also not just success, but solidarity. I always try to emphasize that it's not just kind of a story about a few black folks who got rich out west. Hmm. Greenwood was a place where black folks of all stripes were streaming into in the 1900s and 1910s. Seeking a better life for themselves. In the book, I write a lot about the Goodwin family, J.H. Goodwin, who was an entrepreneur himself and was living in Water Valley, Mississippi in the 1900s, 1910s. But that was a place where if a black man was walking down the sidewalk and a white man came up to him, the black man was expected to scurry into the gutter. Mm. And so J.H. was somebody who said, I'm not going to put up with this anymore. I'm going to go out west to Greenwood. And so he and like so many others helped to build this place up. You know, in the opening of the book, I write a little bit about just what it would have been like on the streets there and how you would have had, you know, the Dreamland Theater, which was this amazing black-owned theater, the Stratford Hotel, the biggest black-owned hotel in America. But you also would have had, like, the mom-and-pop shops. You'd have had some people maybe doing a little bootlegging on the side, maybe got a little opium den going, that kind of stuff was going on. And also you just had a lot of people, you know, doing hair out of their houses, all that kind of stuff. You know, people making it any kind of way they could. And that was really, I think, the energy of the place. It was like everybody had that sort of hustle spirit, whether or not they owned a lavish hotel. You know what I mean? And so that was really what the place was until 1921, when after this elevator incident, a white mob formed to try to seize Dick Rowland, who had been arrested on a false rape charge. And, you know, even in that scenario, things wouldn't have popped off the way they did, if not for the fact that as this white mob was forming, a group of black World War I veterans actually came downtown to the jailhouse to sort of say, you're not going to lynch this guy and defend Dick Rowland's honor and his life. And so there was a shootout in downtown Tulsa when these black veterans clashed with this white forming mob. And so in downtown Tulsa on the night of May 31st, they were shooting in the streets. It was a very chaotic night. Ultimately, the black folks were actually able to essentially like keep the white mob at bay more or less during the night.
How the earliest deacons of defense.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. However, because of this black show of self-defense and force, white Tulsa basically decided that they needed to teach them a lesson. Mm. And so the next morning, they had about 5,000 white folks armed with guns, kerosene, torches, matches, who invaded Greenwood wholesale and burned the entire neighborhood down. They destroyed more than 1,200 homes, several hundred businesses. Up to 300 people were killed. I actually found in my research that there were 6 stillborn babies during the race massacre, which is probably the toughest fact I discovered in all of my research. And, you know, it was devastation. It was the worst act of racial violence, or one of the worst acts of racial violence in our country's history. However, you know, the book's called Built from the Fire because that was not the end of Greenwood's story. And so, you know, the very next day, people like Lula Williams, Mary Jones Parrish, the Goodwin family were out there looking through the records, figuring out how they're going to rebuild their lives. Mm. And they did that. You know, they were able to oppose a lot of real estate schemes seeking to take the land from them. They were able to oppose the Ku Klux Klan literally rising up to be an enormous force in Tulsa after that. And ultimately, Greenwood was built back to be an even larger and more vibrant community in the decades after that.
And that's what people don't talk about.
Exactly.
Right? They just leave it at, oh, there was a riot, there was a massacre, and that's the end of that situation. And folks just gave up.
Yeah. No, there's a photo on the cover of my book of Greenwood Avenue with a marching band going down the street and people on the sides cheering Black the band parade. And all this kind of stuff doing their thing. And that's not from 1915. It's from 1945. You know, it's from a second era of prosperity that Greenwood had. But for me, it was important to really tell the full story. And so after that second era of prosperity, Greenwood was actually destroyed a second time. Hmm. Like almost the same volume of stuff was taken down or destroyed, but it wasn't by a mob, it was by bulldozers sponsored by the city of Tulsa, the state of Oklahoma, and the Tulsa Urban Renewal Authority.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
And so the neighborhood was destroyed a second time due to urban renewal and the interstate construction. And so in that case, Greenwood actually was not able to recover to the same extent. And so, you know, the book, in some ways, it was interesting for me writing the story because it was one kind of tragedy to write about the massacre itself in a very visceral way. But it's kind of like a more aching tragedy when you realize you talk about these folks who like lost their property and sort of lost their community in a lot of ways and sort of knew they were losing it as it was happening over this really slow amount of time.
Wow.
And so the book kind of walks you through very patiently how you go from 1957, urban renewal was introduced as an idea in Tulsa, to 1975, Greenwood's gone.
Mm.
And so I think being able to see that time scale on in a compressed format, you know, I think really helps people kind of understand how oppression can be slow moving at times too. It's not always like 36 hours, you know.
Yeah.
It could be 30 years instead.
Right. So. Your analysis or what you're showing us in this is that it goes from people to policy.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
The systemic nature. That's the thing that, you know, when people talk about Black folk and they say, as in we hear nowadays on TV and from candidates, that there's no racism.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Or people have a difficult time understanding, you know, they think that what's happening to some of the Black people in America is just their own individual failings.
Mm-hmm.
And nowhere is this evident more than these kinds of story where time after time, where Black people against the odds, you know, try to build a life.
Mm-hmm.
And white violence, white mm-hmm. supremacist violence come and destroy that. And the explanation is that Black people are inherently lazy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Black people are inherently criminal.
Mm-hmm.
Black people are inherently violent.
Right.
And it goes back to what you referenced at the very beginning about the master narrative.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
About who gets to tell these stories. Mm-hmm. The big project now at the University of Maryland and I think Howard University, printing hate, right?
Hmm.
Greenwood wasn't the newspapers, if you survey white newspapers all around the country, the kinds of ways in which they were encouraging lynching, like this happened in Wilmington, North Carolina,
right?
Yeah.
Right? Where Black people's community were burnt to the ground and mm-hmm. white supremacists took over and overthrew the government,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Mm-hmm.
So it seems, if you're a conspiracy theorist, it's easy to believe that this stuff happens to Black people over and over, and then it's not taught.
Yeah. Right.
And then this uh-huh. ignorance then allows Black people to be traumatized yep. over and over again because it's like nobody will believe us.
Right. Marginalized.
You know?
Yeah.
So it's extremely fascinating.
Yeah, and I think that those sort of wrong lessons people learn, they just end up seeping into our culture in both obvious ways and subtle ways. And so when I was first, you know, deciding to move to Tulsa, I was in Ubers a lot, just driving around the city, trying to figure out, you know, going this and this way and that way. And oftentimes my Uber drivers, I'd be, oh, you know, I'm thinking about moving to Tulsa soon, you know, we can have that convo. And they'd always say without pause, don't move to North Tulsa. North Tulsa is, Greenwood is part of North Tulsa, expanded Black Tulsa, basically. That's what I hear again and again and again from all these Uber drivers. But I live in North Tulsa now, and it's like perfectly safe, and there are more dangerous parts of Tulsa than North Tulsa. And so, but that was the idea where I think that North Tulsa does have a lot of disinvestment.
Mm.
But when you learn the history, you learn that actually that's part of the policy of the city
exactly.
that actually led to that disinvestment.
Yeah. Yeah.
But
don't
now,
tell them that.
But now when people drive
policy.
Up there, yeah, when people drive up there, they see what it looks like, and they say, oh, this must be the fault of people who live there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's the assumption that people have.
We, and we don't see, you know, Carol Anderson's White Rage. We don't see the policy that have such devastating effect on people's lives as violent,
right.
As inherently violent. With a stroke of a pen, you can dictate who is hungry, who is marginalized, who gets access to this and who gets access to that.
Right.
I think what's so powerful for me is that this is as of today. This is topical and now. There was someone that came, Victor and I led a talk at All Souls Church in Tulsa in the fall, covering the first 9 chapters of the book, part of a great program that Victor has put together with the University of Tulsa on a long-term community read of Built from Fire.
That's awesome.
And we, in that discussion, started talking about you know, the denied insurance claims, almost every property public, you know, private homes, but also businesses as well, in Greenwood. And this lady stood up and said, "Why didn't, you know, why didn't the black community fight for, you know, this? Mm. Why didn't they litigate?" and it was kind of shocking.
Yeah.
And Victor and I were like, "They did."
Have you no self awareness?
Yeah. I mean, in her mind, it was like, well, they were denied,
it didn't work,
and they didn't fight for it.
Yeah.
And that was really shocking to me to hear that in 2023, mm-hmm. in a town that has and is continuing to grapple with this
story. It's like mm-hmm. the people who asked, "Then why didn't the slaves run away?"
Right.
They did.
That's right. Insurrections. Hello.
Right.
You know, but. So in bringing this story to the present,
yes.
one of the things that I think people are concerned about, because this is a topical issue in our current debates, is the story of reparations,
mm-hmm.
right? That Tulsans filed for reparations. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. So there's been several efforts to get reparations.
Why didn't they get reparations mm-hmm. or insurance didn't cover their property that had been burned?
With before? Interest.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So right after the race massacre, more than 100 property owners in Greenwood filed lawsuits against the city of Tulsa and insurance companies seeking restitution. However, I was able to actually have all the lawsuits. I was able to get those from the courthouse. And a lot of the insurance companies and their responses would say basically that, we have these riot exclusion clauses
exclusion
in our contracts.
Clauses.
And so what's interesting about that to me is, first of all, they're saying that they have a riot exclusion. And then when you actually read the narrative, because the insurance companies had to provide a narrative of what happened to prove that they didn't need to pay. And all the narratives say, there was an even-handed battle between whites and blacks. Both white and black property was destroyed. Things that aren't even true about what happened.
Mm.
But they set up this idea of a riot or an even-handed sort of chaotic battle, and that gives them the legal pretense to not provide restitution. And so that's sort of the case for why the initial batch of lawsuits were thrown out. In the 1990s, John O. Franklin was actually involved in another lawsuit with the Living Massacre survivors of that era, who filed again. This is a federal suit. However, that case ended up getting thrown out in part because there had already been cases filed 100 years ago almost, you know what I mean?
Mm.
And so people said, statute of limitations have been exceeded on these cases, and y'all filed once, and the justice system said no, you can't file again. Fast forward to present day, there in 2020 and 2020, three living survivors filed another lawsuit. In this case, it was kind of a more roundabout approach. They claimed that a public nuisance had been created mm-hmm. in Tulsa by the race massacre. And there have been some recent cases, legal cases, that have said, for example, that a company can be found guilty of creating a public nuisance for opioids, for example. There's basically like this new sort of legal framework that says that if you create like a huge cultural or structural problem, you can mm-hmm. be found guilty for that as an mm-hmm. institution, like a city or a company. And so these three people filed this lawsuit, and unfortunately, their suit was just dismissed
wow.
By a Tulsa judge over the summer. They're appealing it right now, but that's sort of been the third major effort, and that one is also facing a lot of headwinds right now.
Man.
It tells us a lot.
Negotiate your contract.
It makes the case why there's critical race theory, right?
Mm-hmm.
How we understand race and the
mm-hmm.
law.
Mm-hmm.
Like the very language that we use. How that continues, that grammar
yeah.
upon which black people were built as non-human beings,
mm-hmm.
as things, as commodities,
yeah.
and how the legal architecture around that continued to support that, you know, even long after slavery was abolished, because we didn't restructure our grammar and our
mm-hmm.
way of thinking.
Right.
It's extremely fascinating.
And I feel like that denial says, well, you're just lucky you made it out.
Yes,
yeah.
It's like, thank God, and please keep
going
along, be along
right.
your way.
Be content. Don't worry.
Yeah, and it's wild how the legal decisions from the Jim Crow era are still given all this weight.
Yes.
So, for example, in the Tulsa case, like I said, all these folks filed lawsuits in the 1920s after the race massacre, and the city attorneys were in the Ku Klux Klan. Some of
mm-hmm.
them were. And some of the judges were also in the Ku Klux Klan. And so I think when you think about the Klan not only being about, like, guys in pointy hoods, but also as, like, a good old boys club,
yeah.
oh,
a group that was, system. Like, conspiring together to advance
mm-hmm.
their own monetary interests,
mm-hmm.
that makes it even more absurd to me that you would let those cases hold weight and limit legal opportunities today to pursue justice, which
mm-hmm.
is what's going on in Tulsa right now.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Brian, you had a fascinating project. You know, were you looking at trees one time?
Yeah, so Victor and I have this thing we talk about, it's really Victor's term of like pulling in additional threads.
Yeah.
Victor has really written this comprehensive book, really for the first time, in my opinion, such a comprehensive history of Greenwood. I've been waiting for this book for a long time. But there's so many other threads to still, explore. Mm-hmm. And so there are multiple projects like that. One was, Victor mentioned Vernon AME. We worked with Dr. Turner, who was a former reverend at Vernon AME, on the last Common Ties project. And our nonprofit organization, music organization, Folk School of Fable and Fable Roots, helped him and Vernon to restore their Hammond organ, which was the first major purchase that Vernon AME made after they paid off their loan from rebuilding the massacre. That was in 1944. That was pretty powerful. But there are other projects. There's a tree that we're documenting that survived not only the massacre, but there's pictorial evidence of it in 1921, but also survived urban renewal and survived a lot of demolition that happened when the college consortium kind of took over a lot of the property in the 80s. So, just documenting things like that, I think, are still important. Victor and I both have talked a lot about this, and I think are on the same page. It's like, it's not just what happened to shine a light during the centennial. That was amazing. Mm-hmm. There was more focus on Greenwood and the story of Greenwood than ever before, but it's what happens now.
Yeah.
And what narratives continue to be told. And sometimes they're massive, like a book, and sometimes they're as small as, finding this tree that is just a survivor, and how that is emblematic and representative of the community as a whole.
So plants can be archives. They can testify.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. I'm sure we can find maybe evidence of the burning in terms of how it has advanced.
I want to say one thing about that has the good ones involved. There was a tree that was a sapling from the tree that survived the Oklahoma City bombing, planted in a major park project in Tulsa. And it was Regina Goodwin that really stood up and said, why are we planting that tree? I mean, that is important, but, she was asking about, how are we representing Greenwood in the larger civic community as well? And so, I think that's also really important about what Victor's done, to really highlight not only the story of the community as a whole, but also look at this one family and their continuing impact.
Yeah. So I know we got to wind down, but I do have this burning question. So you have Greenwood, Black Wall Street. What does Black capitalism look like, and was it different from traditional capitalism?
That's an interesting question. I feel like in the book, I want to explore maybe like the limits of Black capitalism in some ways. Mm-hmm. And I think often in the story, I'm sort of introducing you. Like, obviously, the Black Wall Street story, people are expecting to sort of have it be a celebration of Black capitalism. Mm-hmm. But in the story, I try to introduce other perspectives. Mm-hmm. There may be a different route we could have taken or could embrace. Mm-hmm. So, for example, early in the book, there's a chapter about the National Negro Business League, which was sort of like the sort of prototypical Black capitalist structure of the early 1900s, founded by Booker T. Washington. But in that chapter, I also introduced W.B. Du Bois and sort of his mentality and him talking about how he did not want Black people to get so obsessed with money that they ended up recreating the oppressive structure of the 19th century and the 20th century for Black folks. Later in the book, Du Bois comes back. He's even more radical now. He's like almost, he's on the communist track, by later in the book, later in the story. But I also talk about Paul Robeson, who was, a singer, but then a major activist, and ultimately ended up being totally demonized for sort of flirting with communism in the United States. Mm-hmm. And so there was actually an interesting moment because the NAACP had to make a decision in the 30s, 40s, and 50s era about whether they wanted to pursue sort of a collective action mindset focused on Black economics and sort of the working class, or pursue sort of a breaking barriers mindset. We're going to sort of help Black middle class and upper class people get into white spaces. Mm-hmm. And so they had this huge split, and Du Bois ended up quitting the organization and all this stuff because they went for the latter route, which is sort of how we know the traditional civil rights movement, certainly how you've been taught about it in school for sure. And so for me, it was really interesting to kind of learn and really introduce alternate ideas about how Black progress could have gone.
Yeah.
And I think in the story, too, you kind of get to see how, like, the civil rights movement unfolding in the 60s. In the book, for example, Dr. King came to Tulsa in 1960, sort of as the civil rights movement was beginning to crest. But you also get to see that only a few months after he came to Tulsa, urban renewal was introduced at a nearby church, too. So at one church, King is talking. And a few months later, another church, urban renewal, is being introduced to the community. Mm. And those two things happen in a parallel times. So, like, on one track, you have Black people trying to enter white spaces, doing all this effort. But at the same time, you have urban renewal dismantling Black spaces.
Yeah.
And so talking to folks now who are from that era, they actually tell me, oh, I wish we had been focused a little bit more on the meetings happening about what was going to be happening in Greenwood, as opposed to the meetings happening about how we're going to enter the white diner. You know what
so
I mean?
So much of it was about respectability, too, and that caused serious divisions in the black community. You couldn't see that collectivity.
Yeah. And that was the question, like, how do we achieve equality? How do we achieve that equality of humanity, right? And so Booker T. Washington, W. Du Bois, or, you know, that conversation or debate between those two, but also Marcus Garvey and Mary Church Terrell, you know, and, you know, looking back, you know, hindsight's 2020, we can say that, you know, there are tenets from all of those, you know, perspectives that being brought together could have done much good for the community. And so as we wind down, how can folks support preserving the history of Greenwood and even push forth the idea of entrepreneurship amongst people of color? What's the enduring lesson that we can take from this?
You know, I think on a practical level, there are a lot of local organizations that could use help, funding, all that kind of stuff, you know. The Oklahoma Eagle is a black newspaper being published once a week, and that's a big pull, big ask for them.
Can I subscribe online?
Yeah. Oklahoma Eagle, you can subscribe to them. There are a lot of nonprofits doing really great work in the community. Terrence Crutcher Foundation. I talk about Tiffany Crutcher, who's the leader of that group in the book. Her brother was killed by Tulsa police in 2016, and she became a major police reform activist and is still doing that work in Tulsa. So I think supporting groups like that, I would just say make sure you're supporting groups on the ground in Tulsa.
Yeah.
Because that Greenwood name has traveled a lot of places. Yeah. We talked about that a little bit last night.
The Greenwood Bank or financial system.
Yeah, so that Greenwood name has traveled a lot of places outside of Tulsa. But I think funneling your money to people and causes in the actual community is really, really important. And I think beyond that, I think it's important that people look at this story and say, what are the parallels going on in my community? How did my community experience racial violence in the early 20th century? How is my community impacted by urban renewal? Why is my interstate where it is, not somewhere else?
Yeah.
Those are questions you can ask no matter where you live. And I think when you really interrogate that kind of stuff, it gave you a different perspective on how your city got to be how it is today.
Yeah.
That's such a good point to end on.
Yes. So, Brian, thank you so much for this program, Common Ties, that has brought Victor Lukerson to University of Arkansas, speaking
to
some of our
podcast.
And to the Undisciplined Podcast. Yes. Yes. So we thank you. We look forward to your work. If you all have not purchased it already, Built from the Fire, it has 4.8 stars out of 5 on Amazon.
That's right. Yeah. Here we go.
100 notable books of 2023 New York Times.
Yes.
Let's run it up.
Yes. Exactly. As we run it back.
Thank you all so much. This is great.
Thank you for listening to another riveting episode of Undisciplined. This episode was hosted by Karee Banton and Carnesia Connor. It was produced by Leah Grant. Undisciplined is a collaboration between the African American Studies Program at the University of Arkansas and KUAF. It is available every other Wednesday at KUAF, on Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Follow the African and African American Studies Program and the Undisciplined Podcast on Instagram at @UARK_AAST or visit KUAF.com to listen to all episodes.
If you like today's episode, please subscribe to our podcast on Spotify or wherever you listen to your podcasts and rate us.